With sports car racing news and analysis from around the globe, this is the Double Stint Podcast. Here's John DeGeese and Ryan Marine.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Double Stint, trackside at Daytona, day number 3 in the build-up to the 2020 edition of the Rolex 24. Ryan Marine, John DeGeese, and Slade Perrins will be on this episode. Slade making his Double Stint debut. We'll be hearing from him shortly as we get into a recap of the on-track activity here today. But as we previewed in yesterday's special episode, John, we knew there was an announcement coming. We speculated with a fair degree of certainty that it was going to involve convergence talks between the WEC and IMSA surrounding the future prototype regulations. And indeed, that was the case. A huge announcement earlier today with pretty much all the big names in sports car racing, at least in prototype racing, present here in Daytona. Let's first lay out what was announced today, and then we can dive into the nitty-gritty about what this might mean for the future.
Definitely an historic day, Ryan. We had learned of confirmation of the much-rumored, much-hoped-for convergence, and we got a new prototype formula in LMDH, Le Mans Daytona H. And we don't actually know what the H stands for yet.
It's one of the great mysteries around this, isn't it?
I would think it's hybrid, but they're sort of being a little cryptic right now. Basically, it's a reformatted version of DPI 2.0, by the way it looks, with a lot of influence from the ACO, obviously, for a unified prototype category that will race alongside hypercars, at least in the FIA World Endurance Championship. We know that hypercars will continue to be allowed there, both the production and race prepped prototype hypercars as announced, but there's still some question over whether hypercars will be allowed in IMSA. You could check out a story on SportsCard 365 about that. Little questions there, but I think the overall landscape for the day was definitely historic, monumental. There's not many, a lot of words you could sort of describe it. It's one of those days you almost didn't think would come after all of these talks, all of these speculation, discussions, meetings. We've talked about it for, seems like, years on this podcast. And to actually have it come to fruition in front of your eyes is kind of out of this world, in my opinion.
Well, you were right there at ground zero when the unification between Grand-Am and ALMS was announced. How does this compare in terms of the sense of living in a critical moment in history of the sport? Do you have a similar feeling as you did back in Baltimore all those years ago?
Well, I would put it as a close number two, and that was exactly what Scott Atherton told me after the press conference. I had an opportunity to chat with him, and I sort of asked him, I said, where do you rank this in terms of your career moments? And he said it was a close number two, with the merger being number one, and I think the golden years of the ALMS was sort of number three in his career. But beyond the point, Scott played a huge part in the negotiation process with the ACO, even though he was quote-unquote retired as IMSA president by the tail end of the year during the transition over to John Doonan. Scott laid a lot of this groundwork to happen, and he's actually one of the unsung heroes, I think, in developing this relationship, having had the good standing with the ACO and the FIA all these years. And it was almost sad not to see him up on stage with John Doonan, Pierre Fillon, Jim France, Ed Bennett, and Gerard Nouveau. But we did get a confirmation, you know, like we said, of this convergence. Technical details to come at Sebring during the Super Sebring weekend, where the WEC and IMSA will again be holding their doubleheader at Sebring International Raceway. What we do know of this platform is that it'll be largely based around what we see today with an LMP2, the current four LMP2 constructors, Orica, Ligier, Multimatic, and Dallara, building a brand new type of chassis with a new crash structure, new safety cell that will be accommodating a bigger fuel tank. It will be accommodating a hybrid system that's yet to be defined. It'll be a spec hybrid in the rear wheels, and that's all we kind of know right now, other than the styling cues of what we had understood before as what DPI 2.0 was going to be. So not much was said there, but I think it's still going to take some time to soak it all in.
It is telling, though, I think, that when you read through what little technical information we have at this point, it sounds an awful lot like DPI, and it sounds an awful lot more like DPI 2.0. I mean, I think this really is an endorsement of what IMSA has been working on for the last several years, that effectively, with a few tweaks here and there, that is what these two giants of sports car racing sanctioning bodies have agreed to moving forward.
Yeah, and I think that was to be expected. But when the ACO involves itself with things, there's always a give and take. And I think that, you know, IMSA had to give a little in order for all this to sort of work, I think. That's my personal opinion. But I think they sort of did it for the greater of the sport. Looking forward, you know, as there's a lot of manufacturers interested in this platform, and they weren't going to commit unless it was a global platform. Now we have it, and now the time comes where, when do we get these commitments?
Right, so that immediately becomes the next point of discussion. I know there were a lot of manufacturer reps here on site, others watching from afar, and we're not going to get any news here this weekend, I can't imagine. But this is the news that has been long awaited by these manufacturers. So many have said, well, we were interested in a continental championship or a world championship, but the thing that has them on the fence is the inability to go back and forth between the two. And this seems to be that one thing. If there is a panacea to fix prototype racing, this is it, where no matter what, if you build a car to these specs, you can take it and race it in any of the major prototype long-distance endurance races, the big races in the world for sports car racing. So now that we have what all these manufacturers have been asking for, how soon do we start seeing announcements? Yes, we've committed, we're working on projects.
Yeah, that's the big question right now. And like you said, we're not going to get any commitments in the next couple weeks. I don't think we'll get any commitments until we see the regulations themselves. We spoke to a bunch of manufacturers today. They all pretty much said the same thing. We're waiting to see what the regulations say. I think the general consensus is out there that it will be a lot cheaper than what Hypercar is. Hypercar was priced at around 20 to 30 million euros a season. This is based on the LMP2 architecture, DPI 1.0, more or less, with the hybrid spec hybrid system with a new chassis design. So we're expecting it to be slightly more expensive than what it is today, but nowhere near the costs of what even the Hypercar regs were, which was still a fraction of what LMP1 hybrid was back in the day. So that was the biggest concern from manufacturers. And now we have that settled. There's still no exact price. I think we'll get some more figures by Sebring. Speaking to Hugues de Schoeneck, which was probably a good barometer for all of this, the president of Orica, he said he personally expects 2 to 3 manufacturers to commit to this formula by Le Mans in June. He thinks that by the time we get regulations, then there's going to be some boardroom decisions, and we're going to get manufacturers signed up right away. So, that would be a great news for sure. And also, now you have to look at it, time is of the essence in some ways as well. While IMSA was pretty pragmatic, they always seemed to be a bit ahead of the game when they were developing DPI 2.0, we're now going to have this formula come in a full 6 months earlier than originally scheduled. This formula, LMDH, it's actually quite hard to keep saying that. I know I'm sure we'll get used to it in the months and years to come, but LMDH will first become eligible in the 21-22 WEC season. So that's September of 21. So we're about 18 months out from that point. And sure, it's not as tight of a deadline as what the Hypercar regs were up against. And those are still on track to debut September of 20. Later this year. But I think that we need to get some manufacturers on board by the summer months in order to have this thing be completely green-lighted and in a pretty good state for the first half of the WEC season that year, and then the full rollout, maybe not per se full rollout, but the rollout in the WeatherTech Championship in January of 22, as originally planned with DPI 2.0.
We'll get to who we think this might entice to join in a moment, but I am also curious about the manufacturers that have committed to Hypercar and what this might mean for them. Toyota being the most obvious, because I think it's safe to say they're the furthest along the line in terms of developing a Hypercar. Aston Martin probably second on that list, but we really don't know what the status of that project is now. And then there's Peugeot, Glickenhaus, a couple other projects that maybe they've been holding off, waiting for information like this, and that shapes their decision to go LMDH racing as opposed to hypercar racing. What sense do you have about those that have been in the hypercar camp to this point?
Yeah, it seems to be mixed reactions. Both Toyota and Aston Martin issued statements today about today's announcement. Toyota said, quote, "We want the possibility to improve our road-relevant hybrid technology in WEC, and we welcome the chance to test our technology against even more manufacturers. We are sure this will create even more excitement for endurance fans in the new Le Mans hypercar era," end quote. That does not mention LMDH anywhere, and LMDH is a spec hybrid system. So we know Toyota's position. They're in the middle of building a car, and it's with a bespoke hybrid system on the front axle, something completely different than what we're seeing here with LMDH. So it looks like that everything's moving ahead with Toyota, but they're sort of skeptical on what could happen. With how the balance of performance could be between these two platforms, whether the Toyota could be eligible to race in IMSA if they even are interested in doing that. Aston Martin, on the other side, said, quote, "We await further details on hypercar/LMDH class with interest and look forward to working closely with all parties that the hypercar vision retains its proper position within the global sports car competition," end quote. So that's another pretty bold statement by the British manufacturer that says that, hey, you know, we're building something according to the rules that you announced last June, and now we have another new toy here that's getting more attention. So we'll have to wait and see how all this unfolds. Certainly, the ACO couldn't have just killed the hypercar class after announcing it, you know, just over 6 months ago at Le Mans. So confirming it at six months ago at Le Mans after much debate and much question at that time. So they're going to have to accommodate these hypercars in the meantime. ACO President Pierre Fion confirmed to me that it will that the class, that platform, was still eligible through the end of 26, through the full five-season commitment. So it's going to be interesting to see how all that works. But to answer your question of whether other manufacturers will commit to hypercar, I think it's extremely doubtful at this point. Even Peugeot, which announced plans for a hypercar, I think they're going to go in the direction of an LMDH. Sorry, it's still difficult to get used to this name. Speaking to Hugues de Schoeneck about that, as Orica is widely tipped to be the technical partner for that program, Hugues actually declared that Orica has abandoned plans to build a hypercar because they see no sense in it due to the costs. So all of their focus is on the new global platform, and that could sort of give you some hints on where Peugeot could be headed right there.
Yeah, certainly. And how about then manufacturer interest? Who do you think is lining up for LMDH, starting with the current crop of IMSA manufacturers and those on the outside that have been a part of the technical working group?
So I spoke to Mazda's Nelson Cosgrove, who's replaced John Doonan as the motorsports director there. He confirmed that this current program is confirmed through the end of next year, and they're waiting to see what happens. They need to see the regulations. That's the common answer we got from a lot of manufacturers. They'd like to go to Le Mans. Mazda always has wished that, had that desire to do so. This would enable them to do that, but there's a lot of question marks. Acura declined comment right now. They need time to digest the announcement. The folks at HPD want some time before putting anything on the record. GM issued a very blanket statement from Mark Kent. We'll have to wait and see what happens there. We know the Cadillac program is largely a customer program, so if there's customers out there, I think it would make financial sense for them to continue it, even with a hybrid, even though they're not in favor of a hybrid. Potential new manufacturers on the IMSA side, at least, could be Lamborghini, Ford, McLaren, Lexus. I think those are sort of the favorites. BMW could be a potential. I spoke with Jens Marquardt, director of BMW Motorsport, today. He indicated that wait for the regulations, but their lifespan for the M8 is a little bit undetermined. So with costs being somewhat similar for a GTLM program compared to a top-level global prototype program for at least IMSA, I think that a manufacturer like BMW could perhaps be swayed to do this. But he gave no indication of that. They're waiting to see for more details on the regulations. And he personally is in favor of global platforms. I think he's talked about it a lot. And he gave some hints that the hybrid formula, the spec hybrid, could end up being the same hybrid that's going to be used in the DTM regulations. So if there's a shared component between those two series, that could actually sway BMW into the top class. So we'll have to wait and see there. But Yeah, nobody from Ford here this weekend. Mark Rushbrook is actually at the Monte Carlo rally, so we weren't able to talk to him. McLaren hoped to get some more words from Zach Brown later on that. He declared back in Bahrain that if there were to be a global platform, McLaren would likely be all in on it, but with the priority on a factory WEC program instead of anything in IMSA.
All right, so still a lot to digest. And I guess with that in mind, John, we'll close this part of the discussion just with a summary or your overall view of what was announced today. Briefly, I will interject and say this was about as much as I felt like I could hope for. You knew that there had to be a place for Hypercar coming into the weekend. My hope was there would be an announcement of Convergence, the intent for Convergence, and hopefully some details. And I think that's basically what we got. To expect a whole lot more out of this at this early stage seemed unrealistic. So I leave cautiously optimistic, basically feeling like if things progress the way that has been laid out today, there's a lot that sports car racing fans can be excited about. How about you?
I would agree. And there was a lot of wording in today's announcement that didn't confirm things. That's their intention. It's the plan. It's their projected debut. So things can still change. I think that's something we have to sort of take care of as well. Especially in the past, we've seen a lot of changes in regulations over the last couple of years, particularly on the ACO FIA front. And I think this is the fourth or fifth revision in the last 4 or 5 years that really kickstarted it all with Dieselgate and Audi's withdrawal and then led to Porsche's withdrawal from the WEC LMP1 ranks. So the WEC has still been trying to find its footing on where they fit in the top class category. I personally think this is a home run. I personally think this is the right solution. I know there are people inside the WEC that were pushing for this long before we announced this was announced. It took some detours along the way, but I'm really confident that this is the future of prototype racing globally, and especially at a time where manufacturers are cutting back their involvement financially as they look at other markets, as they look to EV racing, as they look to other strategies in the marketplace. You need an affordable product to go racing, and I think this is something that a lot of manufacturers could get behind.
All right. Well, thank you, John. We'll let you go with that because I know you've got a lot of other things to do as we wrap up our coverage for the day. And as much as this Convergence discussion has dominated the conversation, and I mean dominated the conversation here at Daytona, there has been some on-track activity. I'll touch on the Michelin Pilot Challenge race, which occurred earlier today, a little bit later, but we also had a WeatherTech session today with some pretty big implications, actually, when you consider it's just a practice session. The bolstered LMP2 class appeared that it might have taken a hit due to a pretty heavy accident for the Performance Tech team in the practice session today. We bring Slade Perrins, our new correspondent, onto the podcast for the first time. We'll start there, Slade. That crash was, A, pretty strange-looking to begin with for Don Yount, but it also looked like it might have some serious ramifications for the team, but it sounds like disaster was averted, and we can all be thankful for that.
That's right. There was a moment we were sitting in the media center, and we looked up at the screens and saw a car in the tire barrier on the inside at Turn 6, which is not a place you'd ever see a car there in the wall. And it was beached heavily in the tire barrier. Don Yount in the number 38 Performance Tech Motorsports Orica 07 Gibson managed to get out under his own power, which was great to see. But the car got back to the garage and the team did an assessment. And I spoke to Brent O'Neill, who is the team manager there. And he said that fortunately there's no tub damage, which means it was just cosmetic bits and pieces, and they were able to get the car repaired, and they're still working on it now, as I saw when I went back down the paddock this evening on a Friday here in Daytona. But it will be on track and ready for tomorrow's race, which is great to see. Yes, in fact, amongst all the chaos that we've had today with the IMSA and WEC Convergence, we did have a WeatherTech session, and it was practice for the final practice session for teams to get things prepared and ready for the race on Saturday and Sunday. Kamui Kobayashi ended up fastest for Wayne Taylor Racing. And in fact, across the board in all four classes, the times were set in the very, very early running because of Yount's crash towards the end of the session. The final 15 minutes basically saw it cut short, and they weren't able to do any last-minute simulation laps or fast laps before the race tomorrow. But Kobayashi's time was strong again. And it's the second time this weekend, I think, that we've seen the Cadillacs on top. So it's been a bit of a back and forth between the Acuras, the Cadillacs, and the Mazdas, which is good to see for tomorrow's race because it shows that it will be quite competitive at the top.
I had the same thought, actually, as you were discussing it. I think we've been waiting to see what the BOP would look like once we got closer to the race in DPI, especially coming off of a year that, quite frankly, the IMSA technical department didn't cover themselves in glory with the BOP. There were a lot of heavy swings one way or the other, and for a pretty proud staff that, by my estimation, has by and large done a remarkable job trying to create parity amongst all of their classes. That just wasn't the kind of year that we've come to expect. And so I'm sure that there's been some work done in the off season to try and correct that. And I would agree, early returns here have been incredibly positive. The three manufacturers have been taking turns at the top. I'm not sure the Cadillac is there on outright pace necessarily, but that package has been so consistent over the years, specifically in this race, and really came to life overnight last year. It still seems to me that it's anyone's race, and I have a hard time picking against Cadillac in this race.
Absolutely, yeah. I spoke to Ranger van der Zander earlier today, and he was feeling quite positive for the race, and he said that, you know, obviously they won last year's race, so they ended up at the end on the top step of podium. Yes, it was rain shortened, but they were quick, and they were quicker than night, as you said. But it's going to be a race of survival again this year, as it usually ends up being with 24 hours. It's going to be a time bomb of who falls off the road and who has reliability issues. There's still question marks over Mazda. I know Harry Tinknell is quite confident of where they're at, and I know I've spoken to a few guys from the team, and they're all quite happy and content with what they've seen so far this season at the Roar and this weekend. But you can't help but have question marks over Mazda after what we've seen the last few years. So I think that the BOP is certainly there. I think we're still waiting to see what Acura really have to show. Yes, they have topped one of the sessions this weekend so far. But I think there's still more to be seen from Acura, and Ranger van der Zander felt the exact same way. So I think that come hour four, hour five, we'll start to get a real telltale of where we're at in the race and where the DPI cars are at.
Yeah, always fun to watch that unfold throughout the course of 24 hours. I'm curious, too, about the GT classes, as effectively this is going to serve as our preview for the race. It kind of snuck up on me when you said tomorrow's race. Well, yeah, I guess that's right. I've been kind of playing in Michelin Pilot Challenge land for much of the week and haven't really wrapped my head around just how close we are to the 2020 edition of the race. What have you seen out of GTLM? It is a diminished class because you don't have the Fords in the field. And I had a conversation, actually, with Nick Tandy earlier today, and he said it definitely feels different without having Ford here. And he said especially true at Daytona because of how good at this particular track those Fords always seem to be. But he said the challenge is still just as tough, and I suspect he's right when you look at the fact that the Porsche is new, the Corvette is new, the BMW is probably a bit more rounded into shape than we've seen in previous years, and while the Ricci Ferrari hasn't been on the pace, they did win the last time out at Petit. So you look up and down the roster of manufacturers and teams, and maybe with the exception of Ricci, but I'm not quite counting them out just yet, I think the others, it's safe to say, are in with a shout if things fall in their way.
It is, like you said, it is quite a depleted field this weekend in GT Le Mans. We've only got seven cars, and obviously the absence of Ford is felt. But it seems as if Porsche have taken their place this weekend. They have been quite dominant in the practice sessions, and obviously Nick Tandy, as he said, he is our pole sitter for tomorrow's race in that Porsche. But Corvette were up there today. They topped the practice session. They were quick. So I think that it's going to be closer than we think in GTLM. The Ricci Ferrari seems to be about between 1.5 seconds and 1.8 seconds off in most of the sessions. So I don't know where they're at, and I think they're quite down on horsepower with the BOP. And I know James Calado wasn't particularly happy about that when he spoke to Daniel Lloyd earlier today. So we'll see if they can creep up in the race and get anywhere towards the front if some of the other cars have issues. But I don't see Ricci doing too much in the race. I think it will be definitely a fight down to the two Corvettes and the two Porsches, and BMW will be there somewhere in the middle as well. In terms of GT Daytona, it has been quite competitive between the Porsches, the Ferraris, and Lamborghinis this weekend. Franck Pereira topped the last practice session there in the Grassa Lamborghini. So they They've been quite strong this weekend. I think it will be a very fast outright pace in GT Daytona in the race. So it will be a particularly interesting race to see how that develops over the course of 24 hours, that's for sure.
I think it's also worth noting that we discussed the issues for Black Swan yesterday. Happy to report that they were able to get the second chassis built up, ready to go. They were on track today. That's great news. We did not discuss last night the issues that hit the GRT Magnus team. Evidently, a half-shaft issue, which caused them to have to change out a gearbox. They missed qualifying as a result, but they are also back out on track. Everything good to go. So, looks like all 38 entries will be ready for the race. That's welcome news, and we look forward to seeing what the 24 hours has in store for us when we get to tomorrow morning. Quickly to close things out, Michelin Pilot Challenge curtain opener today, the BMW Endurance Classic. It was won by the Riley Motorsports Mercedes. Jerome Bleekemolen, Dylan Murray, and Jim Cox, the driver lineup there. Interesting, that is their third consecutive four-hour race win, really for two of them, because they won at Watkins Glen, and then Cox and Murray won at the Encore. So, and for Bleekemolen, he was part of the lineup at Watkins Glen. So pretty remarkable what they've been able to do. They were joking in the post-race press conference. They petitioned IMSA to make all Pilot Challenge races 4 hours long because they've had the magic ingredients to this point. But it was a really fun race at the front of the field. We had some lead changes, some high drama. The TCR battle was really, really good as well. And it went through some interesting stages because early on, the pole-sitting Alpha was totally dominant. It hit some problems and ultimately had a pretty big mechanical issue that took it out of contention. That led then to a period of Hyundai dominance, only for that to be interrupted by Audis. And it was an Audi 1-2-3, just as it was a Mercedes 1-2-3 in GS. So really fun racing. So congratulations as well to our TCR class winners, John Morley and Gavin Ernstone for Road Shagger Racing, who were able to get it done. The race did end under yellow because of a very heavy accident for Scott Maxwell at the end of that race. Happy to report that Scott was checked and released from the medical center and he was all right, because it was a scary accident that actually had his Mustang land on its roof, and it took quite a while for him to be extracted from the car. So happy to report again that Scott was okay after a scary accident in the final 15 minutes or so of the race. If you missed it, it should be airing on NBC Sports here in a handful of days. So I think that's a broadcast you're going to want to watch, especially the middle portions of the race were a lot of fun, unless you were a Turner Motorsport fan, because I'll tell you, they suffered through more tire issues than I have seen in a single race for a single team. It was really remarkable. Unfortunate news for them. Will Turner had a good outlook on it. He said, "We were going for a world record." I'm not sure they achieved it, but they might have. Hopefully they can get to the bottom of that moving forward. But again, all in all, a pretty entertaining race.
It seemed as every time I looked at the TV screens, that Turner Motorsport BMW had a tire coming off of some issue or some sort of issue there. So luckily for them, they got to the end there.
Yes, that was hard-earned, to say the least. Not the result they were looking for, but perhaps they can take some solace in that. We'll close the show here this week by just getting your general impressions, Slade. This is your first trip to Daytona, your first Rolex 24. It seems like we've had a newbie in the crowd, myself included, each of the last 4 years. So I'm always curious what the rookie's perspective is. What have your major takeaways been from this first trip to the hallowed grounds here at Daytona?
As anybody would be, I was particularly blown away when I did arrive and see that and saw that stadium. It's just magnificent to see. And, you know, I've watched it on TV for so many years and always dreamt of being here. So to actually be here, it really is a dream come true. In terms of my takeaways, I've said it a few times this weekend. I'm absolutely amazed by how kind and how friendly everybody in the IMSA paddock is. And I've spoken to plenty of people this weekend, and they've all been really friendly and introduced themselves, and I've spoken to them a few times before after that, and it's just been such a great atmosphere and just such a positive vibe throughout the paddock. And that's what I've picked up here this weekend for sure at my first IMSA event at Daytona as well.
Well, I'm glad to hear that it's been a good one for you so far, and hopefully the next 24 hours of racing have some exciting things in store. I should mention as well, before we close, we did have a question that came in from LM11 asking about the budget disparity between hypercar constructors and anyone who subscribes to the new LMDH platform moving forward. I think John touched on that some in our discussion earlier. We might address that again. I'm sure we will at some point on a future episode, but I think it's too soon to say. Clearly, based on the statements that John read, there might be a little bit of knuckle cracking going on in Cologne, the headquarters of Toyota Gazoo Racing and its sports car program. I'm not sure they're thrilled. That's me projecting here. Maybe the same can be said for Aston, depending on how far down the line they are. But, you know, ultimately, I think Toyota has different goals in mind for its prototype program. They talked about it in the statement, in fact, about really trying to use this as a testing ground for their future technology for road cars. And I'm not sure that LMDH, for all of its positive aspects, I'm not sure that's one thing that it addresses. So if this is what Toyota wants, I think they at least have a playground that they can play in and they can achieve those corporate goals using the hypercar platform. And now it's up to the sanctioning bodies to find a way for the two to play nicely together. And I think that's going to be the big challenge of this format if it does continue the way that it's been planned. But thank you very much for writing in. If you do have a question for a future show, you can leave it in the comment section or use the hashtag AskDoubleStint. We look forward to hearing from you on a future program. We'll be back with our post-race analysis. I guess it'll be our next show will be our normal weekly show. We'll be recapping Daytona. I'm sure we'll speak to someone who had a good 24 hours at some point in the post-race that we'll be bringing to you in our next double stint. Thanks so much for tuning in. Hope you've enjoyed these daily podcasts here in the build-up to the race. And again, talk to you on our next edition of the show coming up next Tuesday on Double Stint.